content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's episode, we will finish an article we started last time titled In Search of Troy by Joshua Hammer. It wasn't just a legend. Archaeologists are getting to the bottom of the city celebrated by Homer nearly 3,000 years ago. So Mr. Hammer is walking through the site that they believe to be Troy with the head of excavations at Troy named Rustem Aslan. And they're discovering many layers and proof that there was a city believed where the mythological Troy existed. We'll pick right back up into the article. A quarter mile down the road from Troy, a giant cube of rust-colored steel rises starkly from a sea of corn and wheat fields and olive groves. The Troy Museum, an $8 million showcase adjacent to the ruins that spans 5,000 years of history, opened in October 2018. Its four floors are filled with jewelry, sculptures, sarcophagi, and other objects, including the Hittite treaty tablet, and handsome exhibition spaces surrounding an airy and brightly lit 50-foot atrium. Aslan worked with Turkey's Ministry of Culture and Tourism to secure much of the collection from museums in Kanakale, Istanbul, and Ankara. The process met with grumbling from museums, asked to hand over treasured artifacts, but it still produced a rich tableau of items. Still, a few exhibits verge on the kitschy. One display consists of videos in which Turkish actors and actresses wearing late Bronze Age attire speak the parts of Zeus, Odysseus, Helen, Achilles, Hector, and other characters from the Iliad. The guy who played Hector went on to become a star on the Turkish version of Survivor, Aslan tells me. These days, Aslan spends much of his time trying to persuade museums to return Trojan artifacts, currently dispersed, he says, among 45 collections around the world. This has placed him at the forefront of the international movement to repatriate cultural materials. Aslan led me through a series of concrete passageways between the floors of the museum, meant to conjure, he said, a sense of emptiness and dislocation. On the top floor, a permanent exhibit that helped conceive displays and individual showcases illuminated images of dozens of Priam's treasures still held in the Pushkin Museum in Moscow. Gold earrings, gold pins with rosettes, and a jadeite ceremonial hammer axe. A plaque declares that the collection to be Trojan artifacts longing to be reunited at home. Though the Turkish government has been in talks with the Russians about the return of the objects, they were smuggled out by Schliemann, then held by the Nazis, then seized by the Soviets. Repatriation will be very difficult, Ridvan Guluk, the museum director, told me. It's not very near. Priam's treasures were hardly the only relics Schliemann brought out of Troy. Between 1870 and 1890, he packed everything from bronze kettles to ceramics to gold jewelries into crates and shipped them to Europe. Some valuables found their way to museums and private collections. Others went to Schliemann's friends. And that inventory does not include objects stolen from the Imperial Museum in Constantinople or pilfered by workers from the digs and sold overseas. The Smithsonian holds more than 100 Trojan artifacts, which are part of Schliemann's personal collection, and were donated to the institution by his wife in 1893, after the archaeologist's death. Turkey has never approached the Smithsonian about repatriation, but Sabrina Schultz, curator of anthropology, says that under the institution's framework for deciding on the ethical return of objects, they may be valid candidates for consideration. So far, the Turks have persuaded only one foreign institution to turn over its artifacts since they began planning the Troy Museum a decade ago. In 2012, the Turkish government asked Brian Rose, who is the curator of the University of Pennsylvania's Mediterranean Collection, to examine 24 Bronze Age gold artifacts of uncertain provenance that the museum had acquired from a Philadelphia dealer in 1966. These items included earrings adorned with leaves, brooches, and a necklace strung with beads and ringlets. The Turks suspected they had been smuggled out of Troy in the 19th century and held in private collections until they surfaced with the dealer. Ernst Pernica, an ancient metals expert, tested soil found inside one of the jewels and determined that it contained the same percentage of arsenic found in earth samples from Troy. It was the smoking gun, Rose tells me. The objects were technically shielded from repatriation by a 1970 UNESCO treaty prohibiting museums from acquiring artifacts that left their country of origin after 1970 without full documentation. Still, Rose agreed to a long-term loan of the 24 pieces to the Troy Museum in return for a license to carry on excavations at Gordion, the capital of the 8th century BC Phrygian Empire in central Anatolia. We will never see it again, Rose conceded of the collection, adding, I'm delighted it's displayed so prominently. Rose's handover set a precedent, says Aslan, who has approached the Neuss Museum in Berlin, which has thousands of Schliemann's artifacts, including silver ceremonial cups and other objects of silver and bronze, and the British Museum, which has 300 pieces from Troad, including 200 from Troy. But the talks have led nowhere. They say, if the politicians say to give them back, I will give them back, Aslan told me. They all insist it is a political decision. To Aslan, the scattered remnants being at home in the Anatolian culture that produced them. When they stole the Trojan artifacts, he said, they stole our identity along with our heritage. Back at the Citadel, Aslan told me that the excavations at Troy are far from finished. The lower city needs to be further excavated to settle questions about the size of the late Bronze Age population, the defensive wall, and the surrounding ditch. More tantalizing is an earthen dump at the northern edge of the Citadel Mound, created by workers in the 3rd century BC, to level the surface for a temple of Athena. Some experts suspect the dump could contain something truly invaluable, engraved tablets. Until now, the only evidence of writing in Bronze Age Troy is the Luwian seal, uncovered by Korfman. And the hunt goes on for a late Bronze Age cemetery containing the remains of soldiers killed in battle, along with their weapons. Blegan found nothing more than a few skeletons scattered around the lower city. A more recent remote sensing hasn't turned up anything promising. Over the past decade, a team from the Ege University in Izmir has drilled 500 holes deep into the Troad soil in a futile search for a lone large boneyard. Soon I will try to make the search in a couple of places, Aslan told me, standing above the trench outside the south gate. Eventually, he says, though perhaps not in his lifetime, I am 100% sure that something marvelous will be found. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Inner Passage, text by Imani Perry. Encountering a long-forgotten waterway in the south that tormented many enslaved people and yet helped some escape to freedom. The low country is emerald green and lacing gray. The landscape is visceral. Movement never ceases. Look from the sky and appears as though the water has run veiny through the earth, making islands of common ground. To get from Charleston, South Carolina, one of the oldest cities in the low country, to St. Augustine, Florida, one can go along the coastline, traversing the shallow waters of the Atlantic Ocean. There's another waterway, though, an interconnected series of rivers and hand-dug canals made possible because of slavery. It is a slower, safer, and a historical treasure. Virginia McGee Richards has spent the past 10 years studying and documenting it. She calls it the Inner Passage. When I speak to her over Zoom, she is gracious, even self-effacing, but her curiosity is luminous. I see her eyes travel up to the sky of her imagination as she describes the majesty of the land. Her project includes interviewing local residents and editing a poetry collection written by local students, reflecting on the history of the Inner Passage. She has collaborated with historians like Duke University's Peter H. Wood, the author of a seminal book about colonial South Carolina called Black Majority. Richards herself is a diligent researcher, a historian, and an environmental lawyer, as well as an award-winning photographer. To make these images, she used a mid-19th century photo process called wet plate collodion. My hope, she said, is that images can convey a landscape scarred with secrets, river baptisms, planting seasons, torture, dancing, prayers, African dialects, poverty, massacres, lynchings. The land remembers but cannot speak. By documenting the Inner Passage, I want to give the land a voice. She swam its waters first. Immersing herself near her home in South Carolina became a ritual as she began to photograph the area and uncover the story. What she found was under-recognized and fascinating. The public's image of the South tends to hover in the 1800s, when cotton was king. But the Inner Passage belongs to an earlier colonial Southland, a region that was part of America's becoming. It was often quite unbecoming in that process. Starting in the 1600s, British settlers forced enslaved people to build and maintain these waterways to support trade in deerskins and timber, and later rice and cotton. These men shoveled mud through the malarial swamps while battling snakes and alligators in intense heat, Richard says. The passage grew to be 300 miles long and was eventually incorporated into the Intracoastal Waterway, which still exists today. As early as 1687, the Inner Passage also became a route for black freedom seekers. Long before the Underground Railroad opened up a pathway to the north, enslaved people in Charleston were paddling wooden boats through the Inner Passage, fleeing southward to Spanish-owned lands. Once they reached Florida, they were granted their freedom in exchange for converting to Catholicism. Their descendants were able to live there in relative liberty until the 19th century, when Florida was annexed by the United States. As a daughter and a student of the South, I took a look at Richard's images and find myself having flashbacks of events I never experienced firsthand. Take the live oaks growing along the canals. Over the course of 200 years, Richard says, these trees absorbed the sight of angled elbows against the land, backs arched, as hundreds of men sacrificed their lives to carve canals from the swamp. The trees saw black men burrow so deeply into the gray marsh that they disappeared into it. These oaks are the only creatures still alive today that witness these sights, and by looking at them, we witness their testimony. They tell us of the people who sheltered in their branches or behind their thick brown trunks, breathing heavily, wet with sweat, dew on the grass, and moisture in the air. There is one oak whose trunk has grown around cinder blocks. Nature is a living graveyard. What is eroded is tended to be what remains. This dance between past and present moves throughout the entire collection of images. A photograph taken on the banks of the Stono River recalls the 1739 uprising of enslaved people referred to as the Stono Rebellion. Led by an Angolan man named Jemmy, the group was defeated at Edisto River. Its members were killed or sold in the Caribbean. More repression and rebellions followed in slave societies everywhere. In a photograph taken near Jacksonboro, South Carolina, we see the ruins of the Pompon Chapel of Ease, erected in 1724 and replaced in brick in 1754. That church was then destroyed by a fire in 1801 and became known as Burnt Church, a name that was classically Southern, idiosyncratic, and matter-of-fact. It carried that designation until it was rebuilt between 1819 and 1822. Then it was mysteriously destroyed again in 1832. For nearly two centuries, the ruins have remained. So do the praise houses, simple wooden structures built by and for enslaved people. The church was the first institution of black American life, before enslaved people had property or even a right to domesticity. Praise houses served as places of religious intercession, exhortation, and devotion, and also as sites for conflict resolution, political development, and education. The contrast between the rubble of the Pompon Chapel of Ease and the carefully maintained praise houses makes me think of two words, ruins and runt. Ruins are detritus. Runt, a Southern vernacular term, is a reference to having been destroyed by disgrace and often sexual violation. To be ruined was one of the many forms of violence experienced by the enslaved. The praise house served as a place for spirit cleansing and new life. Many of these structures are still being sustained with tender attention today. The Inner Passage winds through the Combahee River, a small blackwater tributary that is good for bream fishing. Some of these fish are red-breasted, gleaming like fire when pulled up from the water. The Combahee is where Harriet Tubman, the woman called Moses, led black Union soldiers as they freed 700 enslaved people. Three Union gunboats traveled up the river, covertly gathering information along the way. The freedom seekers were waiting for them when they stopped at appointed locations. Richards's photographs taken on the banks of the Combahee function as a subtle memorial. The scenery is haunting when you think about the greed for wealth, the trade in flesh, the way a body could be swallowed up by the landscape. This is a pretty place. Nature has covered the grounds where people died in war or fell to their knees in tears for freedom with a lush carpet of flora. The fauna still dance, the waters still flow. The people who live on the islands of the Inner Passage also carry in their faces. Francis Maybank, a white man and native of Charleston and Jehosi Island, stares at Richard's camera with pale eyes, a sun-weathered face, white hair combed back. Kathy Holmes, a native of James Island, is a black woman with chiseled features, hair drawn back, hooded eyes, gleaming skin. They belong alongside each other in any honest story of what this place is. Witness them both fully and our maps become more accurate, our national story truer. And then there is an image of a little girl, Annalena Hames, barely out of toddlerhood but with a knowing face and a stern brow. Her ancestors first arrived in Charleston in 1683. She is an inheritor of a place that is fraught and breathtaking. To borrow from that sagacious thinker, James Baldwin, I wonder what she will do with all this beauty. What will we do for her? The land insists that we tell the whole story, riotous and chaotic, beautiful and terrible. Richard's photographs remind us to hold its legacy with care. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section, The Law. How to Win Justice by Tomiko Brown Nagin. Pathbreaking lawyer Constance Baker Motley, the civil rights queen, propelled the movement for equality. In the spring of 1963, Constance Baker Motley watched the protests in Birmingham, Alabama, with hope and concern. The nation's most segregated city, Birmingham had become the center of the struggle for black equality. Previous demonstrations that were led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, whom she considered an American hero, had produced no results, Motley wrote in her memoir. Consequently, King and other leaders began planning more dramatic action, including the Children's Crusade. Civil disobedience was not working. Massive resistance was, she wrote. Indeed, the zeal of the protesters in April and May of that year led to a climactic legal battle. Motley's heroic role in what helped lay the groundwork for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as public outrage over the violent white response to peaceful protests spurred Congress to action. The pathbreaking protege of Thurgood Marshall, Motley had spent many years as the only woman lawyer at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, LDF. She had written the original complaint in Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954, which helped desegregate public schools, and would later help integrate flagship public universities in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. Now King, whom she had rescued the previous year from a dank, dangerous cell after he was arrested during a protest in Albany, Georgia, again reached out to the LDF in hopes of saving the campaign in Birmingham, which was faltering under abuse from local law enforcement. It was a desperate plea, Motley recalled. On April 3, 1963, King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, alongside local activists, launched the five-week-long Project C, the C standing for Nonviolent Confrontation. The courts posed an immediate threat. Local Justice W.A. Jenkins had prohibited a protest planned for Good Friday, April 12th. Out of respect for the Brown decision, King had vowed never to violate a federal court order, but he felt no such obligation toward bigoted state and local judges. Injunction or no injunction, he said at press conference, we're going to march. King, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, and the Reverend Ralph D. Abernathy defied the court order, marching with around 50 protesters from the Zion Hill Baptist Church into the city. King was jailed for contempt of court after the Good Friday march, spending 8 days behind bars, where he composed his well-known manifesto, Letter from Birmingham Jail. King knew he would need the right lawyer to beat back the greater legal challenges to come. Enter Motley, known as the Civil Rights Queen, for her courtroom feats. Released from jail on a $300 bond, King faced trial for contempt of court. Motley, joined by three male lawyers, served as his defense counsel. Her reputation drew a crowd. On April 23rd, the Jefferson County Courthouse teemed with spectators. Black Alabamians had come from all over to see the Columbia University-trained woman lawyer who famously took no prisoners, recalls Clarence Jones, a close advisor to King. Courthouse employees, nearly all white women, piled into the court to watch Motley challenge segregationists with her signature tenacity. When a dismissive prosecutor pointed a finger at Motley and called her she instead of Mrs. Motley, the lawyer responded, "If you can't address me as Mrs. Motley, don't address me at all." Unhappily for King, the judge presiding over the trial, W.A. Jenkins, was the same judge who initially prohibited the demonstration. In her opening argument, Motley spoke in her characteristic low, steady voice. There's not a shred of evidence, she insisted, that these defendants engaged in unlawful activity of any kind. Regardless of the court order blocking the demonstration, protesters could not legally be punished, and black protesters could not be singled out for exercising constitutionally protected rights to assemble. Under Motley's cross-examination, W.J. Haley, chief inspector of the Birmingham Police Department, admitted the city had targeted movement leaders and acknowledged the mass arrests were the first time in 20 years the city had enforced the law against parading without a permit. Still, Jenkins found the leaders guilty and sentenced each to 5 days in jail. Motley appealed to no avail. Indeed, the movement sputtered even after the minister's release from jail until King, on the advice of SCLC comrade the Reverend James Bevel, had Project C begin recruiting school children for demonstrations. Hundreds of youngsters, including prom queens, athletes, and academic standouts, joined the protests. On May 2nd and 3rd, the school children, soon to be Motley's clients, skipped class, gathered at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and marched toward business districts singing freedom songs. "We Shall Overcome," "No Freedom," and other hymns, recalls Audrey Faye Hendricks, who was only 9 years old and joined the marchers. Still, though, Bull Connor, Birmingham's notoriously racist commissioner of public safety, ordered his men to arrest the students by hundreds. Locked in the city's juvenile detention center, the children ate peanut butter sandwiches and slept on mattresses on the floor. Outside, Connor's offices began violently suppressing the remaining children. Reports and images of police hosing down and clubbing the youngsters horrified a global audience. Meanwhile, in a stunning act of retaliation, Birmingham's school superintendent ordered the expulsion or suspension of all students who had joined the youth marches. Parents were upset, and King's controversial decision to involve the children drew intense criticism. At the precarious moment, Motley responded by filing a lawsuit in federal court, arguing that the school board's action violated the rights of all 1,100 students who had been penalized. By suspending or expelling participants in the children's crusade, Motley's legal brief contended, the superintendent had made the legal process an instrument of racial discrimination. The judge in the case, Clarence W. Allgood, a segregationist chosen for a lifetime federal appointment by President John F. Kennedy, addressed Motley in patently sexist terms. He wanted to know, Motley later recalled, how it was that I, a woman lawyer, was the only one arguing the proposition, rather than her male co-counsels. Employing a tactic that Thurgood Marshall had urged fellow black lawyers to use in the face of bigoted comments, Motley deflected the insult and pushed back with cool professionalism. She answered, "Well, because I am the legal defense fund attorney assigned to this state, this case, and I have prior experience in issues of this kind, and these local lawyers are not experienced in these matters." Of all the attorneys in the courtroom, Motley insisted that she, in fact, had the greatest claim to be there. In response, the judge blurted, "You're a woman. Would you have your children out in the streets demonstrating?" "Well," Motley countered, "we're not here to discuss the morality of it or whether I have my children here, but whether we are going to enjoin the school board from keeping these children out." She was also one step ahead of Judge Allgood. She had taken the extraordinary measure of alerting the U.S. Court of Appeals to expect a challenge to Allgood's anticipated unfavorable decision. Motley's appeal swiftly prevailed, resulting in an appellate decision that the New York Times termed a sharp rebuke of the Birmingham judge. The children could not lawfully be punished from protesting segregation, the appeals court ruled, and ultimately returned to school within 24 hours of the superintendent's retaliatory action. Their futures would not be ruined. Historians often divide the movement into two antagonistic wings, with activists like King on one side and lawyers like Thurgood Marshall, who considered King an upstart, on the other. But we see a fuller, truer portrait of the civil rights movement when we view it through Motley's work, which spanned the worlds of lawyering and activism. Unlike Marshall, Motley was just seen as a movement lawyer who embraced direct action. Still, her defense of the Birmingham Civil Rights Campaign is now barely remembered. So intent on highlighting King, many historians paid too little attention to legal strategies that helped the movement succeed. For his part, King would often call attention to Motley's vital role as the movement's lawyer. In a 1965 column in New York's Amsterdam News, King cited Motley among the great American litigators who had made strides for social change, alongside Clarence Darrow, Wendell Willkie, Charles Houston, and others. Motley's efforts and commitments kept protests alive in Birmingham and beyond, with enormous consequences. The Good Friday protests and the Children's Crusade made it all too clear to white Northerners the abhorrent violence of segregation, creating the national political will to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In 1989, during a lecture at University of Virginia, Motley reflected on women's pivotal role in the movement. If the women had not been there night after night to support Dr. King, the movement would have failed. And we'll finish today's episode with some questions from Ask Smithsonian. Teresa Hall from Scarborough, Ontario asks, when did our ancestors start losing fur? There wasn't any one event when our bipedal ancestors left the woods for the grasslands, but after they did, starting about 2 million years ago, their survival depended on sweat cooling the body. Developing a high density of sweat glands and shorter, finer body hair made cooling more efficient. But as with all evolutionary benefits, there were disadvantages. In this case, damage to cells from intense sunlight. Skin pigmentation helped regulate the damage, changing to maintain the health benefits of sunshine as humans also spread to cooler, cloudier places, says Rick Potts, the director of Smithsonian Human Origins Program. And Judy Schwender from Paducah, Alabama asks, did the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs strike on land or at sea? The asteroid impact took place 66 million years ago in an oceanic part of the Proto-Caribbean. Recent studies indicate that the Earth's crust in this area contained a lot of sulfur and hydrocarbons, which are released by the impact. This sent enormous amounts of soot and sulfates into the atmosphere, which cooled the global climate and acidified the ocean. These were probably important factors in the mass extinction. Had the asteroid hit land or part of the ocean where the rocks had a different composition, the effects might have been less severe. Scientists are still trying to unravel the specific reasons why some organisms disappeared while others survived, says Matthew Carano, curator of Dinosauria at the National Museum of Natural History. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.